This week in Washington, more so than any time in Joe Biden's presidency, the news has been all about the news. To start, it's the weekend of the White House Correspondents Association dinner, which is Mardi Gras for the press and politicians, schmoozing with celebrities at scores of events here in D.C. Outside of the brunches and parties, a different type of media intrigue has been dominating politics. BuzzFeed News, the colossus of yesteryear's viral reporting, and the entity that published the infamous Steele dossier about Donald Trump, announced that it was shutting down for good. On Monday, Fox News fired Tucker Carlson, their top-rated host. Within an hour, Don Lemon announced that he was parting ways with CNN, where he had worked for 17 years. On Thursday, Vice News, another struggling pioneer of 21st century digital news, became the latest media company to lay off some of its best-known reporters. These are all isolated events with circumstances specific to each newsroom, but in an excellent new book called Traffic, Genius, Rivalry, and Delusion in the Billion-Dollar Race to Go Viral, Ben Smith argues that we are indeed at the end of an era in media. And he also says that the next one might just be something to look forward to. I'm Ryan Lizza. This is Playbook Deep Dive. Ben Smith helped define the last era of media, starting early in his career as a blogger when that was something still edgy and cool. Then as a longtime reporter here at Politico, the top editor at BuzzFeed News, the media columnist for the New York Times, and now as the founding editor of the new media company Semaphore. His book Traffic tells a story about the origins of the modern media and the sometimes poisonous consequences it has had. It does its best to answer the questions we all have about why our political culture is so fragmented, and whether there's any hope that we can return to a place where Americans agree on simple things, like facts. Along the way, the book chronicles the rise and fall of some of the key architects and institutions of the modern media. For example, Matt Drudge and Andrew Breitbart, whose eponymous websites still have a hammer lock on right-wing politics. And on the left, Jonah Peretti, Nick Denton, and Arianna Huffington, who were the forces behind BuzzFeed, Gawker, and the Huffington Post, which together had enormous influence on their rivals in just about every legacy media institution. Ben makes some provocative predictions about what the next era of news and politics will look like. Perhaps most surprising, that it's not all bad news. In fact, there are promising signs that consumers like you, who are unhappy with the ugliness and the half-truths that defined the past two decades of media, may be imposing your will to ensure that the next era is better than the last one. Part of the change in media of the last 2 to 3 decades is the decline of authority and how it's been attacked, and single narratives about any events are almost impossible now to find.
I think the pendulum always swings in media, actually. It's sort of, I felt like in the book, I was sort of watching that, you know, over 20 years, watching really what people's preferences and people shift and people's reactions to what they were seeing shift. I don't think what people want is sort of a fixed point. I think different cultural moments, people kind of want and need different stuff. But no, I think the big challenge for everybody in media, in institutions, is to try to sort of prop up the existing institutions and to build new ones. That said, I think that like that thing you said about that we should all agree on a narrative, I think that's a little ambitious. Like, how about we just agree on some facts? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it would be great if you could just tell everybody what the narrative was and they would all just go along, or maybe it would be terrible. I don't know. It depends what you think.
Yeah. No, that's fair. Absolutely. Well said that before you even get to the narrative, the facts are completely contested now. I guess I'm channeling a little bit. You ever read that book by Martin Gurry, the former CIA guy, The Revolt of the Public and the Crisis of Authority in the New Millennium? Perhaps it's the era is just dead, but I think his big point in that book is that single authoritative narratives of almost any historical event now are almost impossible for there to be a consensus around them. And that's probably the most important thing shaping the decline in trust, the decline of authority of institutions, including the media. And I mean, you know the familiar examples, right? Like, you know, the rise of the blogosphere when it started attacking the mainstream media, or any other internet-enabled attack on a formerly respected institution. Do you think that that pendulum will ever swing back, or is that simply the nature of modern technology?
I don't think that most consumers look at the current ecosystem and say, wow, this is great, I want this.
right.
You know? And so I know, I think people are, I think basically in a healthy way, retreating from this, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, this single platform where everyone in the entire world battles over a shared narrative, and finding voices that they can trust in a smaller scale way, which is, by the way, like the historical operation is everybody in the same place fighting over the same narrative.
Yeah.
I would just say, though, I mean, this is, I guess, my own ambivalence. Like, you know, the institutional media had massively discredited itself in helping to produce the obviously worst foreign policy decision in modern American history, the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, it wasn't a total coincidence that people got mad at the institutional media.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously why Barack Obama became president. That's what drove the early left-leaning blogosphere with the Howard Dean insurgency, right? I mean, that's what, in your narrative.
Yeah, and I think these institutions had, like, had become, were really, and still in many cases are really, like, kind of sclerotic and failing. And so I hope, I guess, that ultimately this kind of challenge is going to have reinvigorated them. It seems to mostly have done that for the times, rather than push them into some other weird place.
Looking at the future, I mean, just to go back, Gawker's now gone. Huffington Post was swallowed up by BuzzFeed, which sadly is now gone. Breitbart doesn't exercise the same influence on the right as it once did. Trying to think of the other early examples in your book. You know, the Drudge Report's not what it once was, but still, I think maybe having a slight comeback. I find myself leaning more than I used to.
Yes. You know, my colleague Max Tonney said to me the other day, you know, I find myself going to Drudge to see what's happening rather than to see what Drudge thinks. And it's because Twitter remains, I mean, whatever madness is happening over there right now is like pretty riveting, actually, I think. Like watching it.
Well, sure, the spectacle is riveting. Decline. Yeah.
But it used to just serve this very like particular service for me as an editor in the business of news, which is I would wake up and think, what is happening in the world? And I would go to
Twitter.
How do
you do that
now?
And I would
learn what is happening in the world. And Twitter just doesn't work for that anymore. It's people yelling about Twitter.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So,
for me, it's been a while, even pre-Elon, but
yeah. So if you want to know what's happening, like if I was looking at Twitter, I would have missed all the Middle East conflict over the last several weeks. Just wasn't on there for me. So
exactly.
I don't know. I look at the New York Times. I read a bunch of emails. You know, I read Principles. I read Playbook. I read Axios. I look at front pages of newspapers. I look at the Drudge Report's homepage. I look at the Huffington Post homepage. I feel like I'm living in 2007.
Wow. That's fascinating. That's really your media diet now. So it really has... the pendulum has swung that far.
Yeah, and I would love someone to, you know, pull it all back together in one app for me that was both personalized to the degree that it showed my interests, but sort of public enough that I knew what everybody else was talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what a newspaper front page does. It tells you what other people think is important. And I think there are efforts to do that. I think that app Artifact is probably the best one I've seen, although I think they... you know, have the usual Silicon Valley dream of turning it into a UGC thing. Which
wait,
will probably...
unpack that. What is UGC?
Oh, sorry. Like user-generated content. They don't want to be relying on professional publishers and wind up having to pay anyone. So my guess is that that will kind of doom them to drift off into irrelevance. But I would love to have that back. It's really inconvenient to have all these tabs open.
You started at Politico when, you know, Van de Haaye and Harris came to you and said, look, you know, we're going to tell people what reporters are... not just what you know, what's happening in the at the events they're covering, but what they're talking about at the bars after the campaign events are over, and it's going to be a more casual style, and we're going to, you know, pierce the veil of all the bullshit that the places like the Washington Post and the New York Times have sort of built up around their political reporting. And At Semaphore, I think there's a similar sensibility with the newsletters and having, you know, having your reporters be a little bit more voicey and, you know, here's what they know. That's been a decade plus trend in media. In even places like the New York Times are much more willing to embrace that style, at least in some of their formats. At the same time, that same period has coincided with like dramatic reduction of trust in the media. And, you know, I think about this all the time because Playbook, we're constantly wrestling with how casual should we be? How, you know, free-flowing should we be versus how authoritative should we be? Does being more casual and even using, you know, using the first person, does that actually impact trust, which is probably the most important thing in journalism? How intention are those two things and what's the right balance?
Well, I mean, I guess I think that most broadly, you know, the huge trends that have undermined trust in institutions, not just in media, aren't something you're going to change by changing whether you write in the first or the third person.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like these are huge global trends that aren't actually particularly even connected to media.
Sure.
I think what you can do if you want people to trust you is try to, you know, align with where reality actually is. I find an overly like kind of forced casualness pretty annoying. And
yeah.
I do think it undermines authority. But I think that where people see authority and where you draw authority from has changed. I mean, if you're the New York Times, that is a brand that asserts a level of authority that, you know, like for at least some people, you just say it's the New York Times and that is good enough for them. Not for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, for a lot of people it isn't. But if you're...
So you shouldn't mess with that. If you're an editor at the Times, you shouldn't mess with that. You shouldn't adopt the...
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a bigger challenge for them in a way because they have this big brand. And Politico, you know, which has been around now for 15 years and in a space has an authority, you know, like also to some degree has to sort of weigh, you know, our brand versus the journalist brand. I mean, the nice thing about starting something new, although also obviously the challenge is you're just sort of like, okay, where are things now? And for us at Semaphore now, it's just clear that people are much more likely to say, okay, you know what? I trust this journalist because she's been covering Wall Street for 15 years. She breaks a lot of news. She seems like she knows what she's talking about.
Yeah, Liz Hoffman.
Rather than I'm going to trust this brand I haven't heard of. And or, you know, I've been writing about media and politics for a while, so maybe you trust me on that. And so we're really trying to be pretty disciplined about saying, here's the factual piece, here's the, you know, the hard news, and then here is the reporter's perspective. We recognize that those are different things, by the way, like, and have enough confidence that if you're producing some kind of provocative analysis,
you segregate them in your pieces, right? I mean,
yeah, that's right.
Because
I think if you're producing some sort of interesting provocative analysis, like you could be wrong. Because otherwise, it's going to be really banal, boring analysis if you're not taking the risk of being wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, if you have a reporter who knows what they're talking about, if you have your old colleague Max Tani writing about media, like, you do want to know what he thinks. But also, he could be wrong, and he should have the confidence to say, you know what, I could be wrong, and by the way, here's somebody who disagrees with me. And I think our theory and also experience has been people trust you more when you're open to the possibility, not that your facts are wrong. Nobody's going to trust you if your facts are wrong, but that your analysis could be wrong, that there are other perspectives.
Yeah.
And so that's really how we're trying to do it.
So in the DNA of Semaphore is to present analysis as not necessarily the final word on this, but from...
Yeah, but from a person's perspective. And we can have disagreements among ourselves. I mean, I think that people are kind of allergic now to being told what to think, to this kind of voice of God. And I think there is a challenge for traditional news organizations that very classic article form that is a set of assertions that say, you know, here's what happened, here's what it means in a more cosmic sense, here's who's good and here's who's bad, blends these different kind of assertions in a kind of uncanny valley way. And you're like, wait, what are the facts here? And what is just the point of view of the New York Times or of this specific reporter? And I think the problem is that, you know, or the asset is that a lot of readers have sort of caught on to that. And the old tricks we used to use where you just like, you don't have an opinion of your own, but you choose an expert who you quote
right,
saying the thing that you actually think. Like, people have caught on to that trick. You know, you might as well just say what you think.
Tell me how the book, why you wrote this book, what was the original idea behind it that made you want to delve into all of this, you know, early aughts history?
Well, you know how, like, whenever you're part of anything, there are people around who say, oh, but you missed the really good part.
Yeah.
Like if you're there at the sort of what feels like the beginning of anything, there's always someone who's like, oh man, like too bad you weren't here like a year ago. That's when it was really amazing.
Yes.
And so I was basically a pretty early arrival to digital media, and I think I'm seen that way. But I always felt that I had kind of missed out on the really interesting stuff early on. I was a political reporter and blogger and starting in 2004 in New York. And around me were these interesting things, Gawker, Huffington Post, BuzzFeed, that I kind of knew about ambiently, but really, like, I was covering New York City Hall and blogging for the literal thousand or two of people who really cared about that.
But in a sense, even though you were blogging and that was kind of a new thing, you had a more traditional start in journalism, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I'd come out of being a hard reporter, and in some sense, to the degree it was an innovation, the thing that I was doing with some others at that time was saying, like, oh, you can take this format called blogging, which is associated with kind of screedy long-form stuff that's unreported and opinionated, and you can use it to get information and check facts and put them on the internet, which felt incredibly novel at the time. But so I also did have my face pressed to the glass a little at what I could see was this kind of stew of innovation happening in Lower Manhattan around digital media. But I didn't really know what was going on. And then I kind of joined that stream later in my career when I started BuzzFeed News in 2012. And so when the pandemic hit and I had a little spare time on my hand, honestly, because I was writing once a week for The New York Times, you know, I just thought, I would love to go report out that moment. And it also felt, even in 2020, like we were kind of at the end of an era. And I guess sort of the idea for the book, which I really do think this has borne out, was that there was a moment that was passing, and I wanted to kind of go back to the beginning of it. And it was actually so fun to go and bother all these people I'd slightly idolized from afar or loathed from afar, and ask them what the hell was going on, which is a lot of what I did with the book, and say, like, what was going on in this kind of very dynamic, intense, often divided scene in Lower Manhattan.
I think this is why a lot of listeners in our audience will like this book a lot, especially with the way you're describing that era, very similar to me and why I love this book. And one, I love this book because it's very well written. You reported the hell out of it. I was just blown away by how much reporting you did. And like you, I kind of lived through that era, but watched it from afar. I had in hindsight, a pretty like traditional journalism trajectory, internships in New York and DC, and then, kind of fairly mainstream publications. But all of that coinciding with this history that you report out in Traffic of the rise and fall, maybe, of digital media. And so I thought I knew some of these characters and some of these stories, but realized how little I actually did know. So what's the era? You said there that we were at the end of an era, so it was a good time to write this history. Just let's start there with the end of the era. Define that.
I mean, I think there was an era in which publishers discovered this direct connection to their audiences through, at first, just the pure kind of like, mathematical feedback loop of traffic. And then social media, starting in around 2010, really, really accelerated that. And both, gave some of us these massive audiences, but also put us into this very intense feedback loop with all these temptations to sort of really, a more extreme temptation, the temptation that is always in media to tell people what they want to hear.
Yeah.
And I think this book, rose to enormous, kind of universal scale, and everybody was kind of immersed in this flood of social media and of news totally intertwined with social media. Mm-hmm. And then we all got sick of it in various ways. And I think that, this isn't like a, meteorite hit the planet and the dinosaurs are going extinct. This is social media is social. And I think people like got tired of going to that nightclub where everyone in the entire world is there screaming at the top of their lungs and are going off to different places now.
You start the book and you trace the careers of two very interesting characters that a lot of people will be somewhat familiar with. Jonah Peretti, who's your old boss at BuzzFeed, and Nick Denton, the creator of the Gawker empire. Why did you choose those two characters?
You know, I thought that they were both two of the most influential kind of central figures of digital media, you know, incredibly influential across lots of other things that everybody is doing now, from Politico to the New York Times. But also they were real rivals who had different points of view on the world. And I think that's why, for me at least, it was valuable to talk about them. I mean, I remember when I got to BuzzFeed, Jonah was always kind of looking over his shoulder at Denton. Yeah. And I hadn't really thought of Denton as a publisher. I thought of him as kind of a troublemaker and provocateur. I hadn't thought of him as in some way in the same genre. And then I was like, and it was
even
really,
at that
it
point.
Was
just interesting.
Yeah, I'd come from Politico and out of politics and didn't really see the media industry per se. And it was just so interesting to me to be like, oh, okay. There are these different strands and different versions of digital media. And these two guys who see the world really differently. Denton, I think, saw not wrongly all the hypocrisy and bullshit of particularly kind of post-Iraq and Iraq War era Washington media more than anything else, I would think, and wanted to publish the things that, you know, the journalists knew but wouldn't say about how full of shit everybody was, you know, which could easily be taken to extremes but also felt incredibly refreshing in that moment. And Jonah had this totally different point of view where he was really coming more purely from the internet, from doing weird pranks and stunts on the internet, and kind of wanted to delight people and to make, you know, instant, global, fun, cultural things that, might or might not have had some kind of a progressive political edge sometimes, but were about an idea of the internet that was that people would kind of be their best selves in this kind of sweet public new internet, rather than that it would be a place that they could be their kind of like true worst selves.
Interesting. But the tracing of their relationship is fascinating. There's a lot of these early relationships that become so important. And you've really excavated this period of the 21st century where this stuff that was happening from, you know, 2000 to 2010 is so relevant right now. The other relationship that you explore that I think a lot of listeners will find fascinating is one that I've always been curious about and didn't really know much about, and that is between Matt Drudge and Andrew Breitbart. Tell us a little bit about that relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just to pull back a little, to me, one of the most interesting things in reporting out the book, like maybe the biggest surprise to me was how when you go to this kind of progressive, basically politically downtown New York media scene, progressive in the terms of the 2000s, which is, say, incredibly sexist, actually, intertwined with it are all these figures who you and I would now obviously associate with the right. Andrew Breitbart was a co-founder of Huffington Post. The co-founder, the guy who created 4chan, worked out of BuzzFeed's offices for a while. Steve Bannon, you know, wandered through HuffPost to check it out. And it's so hard to put your mind back into that period, but and into a moment when Arianna Huffington, who at that point was liberal, would have thought that the right way to start a liberal website to rival Drudge was to poach Drudge's guy, Andrew Breitbart. Because,
just explain who he was, who Andrew Breitbart was to Drudge, and why needed him.
Yeah, but the overall thing was just because being of the internet was more relevant than what you're – it was the internet versus the real world rather than right versus left was a more meaningful polarity in that moment. And the dominant figure on the internet since the 90s, the political internet, had been Matt Drudge, this sui generis, quirky, you know, mischievous assignment editor, essentially, for the whole media, who was so widely read that he drove a lot of the conversation. But and all he did and does is post well-headlined links to his website, his one-page website. But that's like a 24/7 job, and you need to sleep. And he had an anonymous minion helping him out. And that was a guy named Andrew Breitbart.
And minion really is the key word here. I mean, what you really tease out is how awful Drudge was to this guy. Andrew Breitbart, for people who don't know, is he died pretty young. But his 10 years.
Yeah, Breitbart was this kid in LA who was working a terrible job at like CBS, you know, in kind of the early waves of digital entertainment media and hating it, and reading message boards on the old Usenet, and discovered Matt Drudge before the Drudge Report, when Drudge was just, you know, posting what would become the Drudge Report to these message boards about Whitewater and things like that, the Clinton scandals, and got really into it. And Drudge became his idol. And so when he had an opportunity to help Drudge write the Drudge Report, it was this incredibly fun, engaging thing for him. I mean, being a conservative in LA, you know, makes you a bit of a weirdo outcast anyway, basically.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, also his probably his self image anyway. But no, and he actually got to meet Drudge, and it was, you know, came and who drove up in his little car and came and visited him, and Breitbart sort of felt basically accurately that he had kind of seen the future of media, and then he became for years essentially the guy who helped Drudge post links in the afternoon, and if you were a savvy young reporter looking for traffic, as I was, you would email Andrew. You know that between like noon and 5 p.m., if you wanted to get linked, you'd probably email Andrew rather than Matt. And Drudge paid him, he said sort of inconsistently, he got paid, but he had no ownership in the site, and it was sort of an odd, informal relationship. But, you know, the flip of it was that he had this kind of incredible power, and an acquaintance recalled like sitting around at the Super Bowl with the legendary nipple slip. And
yes,
seeing Breitbart, and Breitbart is just this anonymous guy at the party who nobody quite knows what he does for a living. But he then posts that link and frames it on the Drudge Report. And his language pretty soon is driving all of the coverage in America. And these people at the party are like, wait, what is this? Who is this guy? And he sort of called the Drudge Report, right? And so like, it was never going to be the Andrew Breitbart Report. And so he had this strange mismatch between kind of his cultural power and relevance and his total anonymity.
So it's amazing how small this world is. So Andrew Breitbart, who is, as he's self-described once, and I think you use this a couple of times in the book, you know, Matt Drudge's bitch, and has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about how Drudge doesn't really appreciate him. There's an incredible story where Breitbart, his own book, Breitbart himself puts the link to the book on Drudge, and then when Drudge logs on, he just takes the link off without saying a word. And so Andrew Breitbart couldn't even promote his own book on Drudge. So to me, that the relationship is this. Tell me if I'm overstating this, but it's almost this abusive relationship between Drudge and the person who idolized him, Andrew Breitbart, and Arianna Huffington, the formerly conservative, wants to create the sort of progressive version of Drudge, and she poaches Breitbart from Drudge to help do it. And Arianna, Jonah Peretti, and Andrew Breitbart are all at the founding of the Huffington Post, and all, of course, go on to be incredibly important figures in digital media and characters in the rest of the book. When was it that you discovered like that early history, that there was a straight line between that stuff and what's happening now?
These are not people who have spent a lot of time telling that story. Matt Drudge kind of succeeded and survived by just basically remaining the homepage and not participating in any other particular way in the media. And yeah. Breitbart told a kind of self-mythologizing version of himself where he left out Drudge because I think he felt he didn't have the right to tell that story.
Let me ask this question, more general question. This set of characters, Jonah Peretti and Nick Denton and Matt Drudge and Arianna Huffington and Andrew Breitbart, who were so important in building, you know, both the institutions that became really, really important and also on their own, you know, BuzzFeed and the Drudge Report and Breitbart.com and the Huffington Post, but also in the way that they influenced so many other institutions, Politico, of course, but then all the other mainstream legacy media institutions. Jonah Peretti did not have a journalism background. Nick Denton, you know, he wrote for The Telegraph. Obviously, Drudge didn't have a journalism background. Obviously, Arianna didn't. Breitbart didn't. I mean, none of them had traditional journalistic backgrounds. When you're talking about Jonah, you say something like, he wasn't concerned with taste or quality or brand or consistency. He just wanted to know what would get traffic. I think there's a line about, you know, he was immune to embarrassment, throwing internet spaghetti at the wall, waiting to see what would stick. How much did it matter? And then this to say nothing of like Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, the folks who started Google and all of our other tech overlords. How much did it matter that none of these folks, with a few exceptions, had any traditional journalistic background and that these were the creators of the modern media ecosystem?
I mean, I think there are two different, really kind of distinct strands here. And one is, as you say, essentially people coming from California, from out of tech, who think, well, you know, let's just figure this stuff out from first principles. Let's not really pay attention to the media industry, or really particularly see ourselves as part of the media industry. And that's certainly where Jonah was coming from. Let's just figure out what people are interested in. You can call it journalism or not, who cares? And sort of see what travels, see what works. The other, though, was a very deliberate kind of, I think, rebellion against the media industry. I mean, Nick had worked for the Financial Times. Anna Holmes, who founded Jezebel, you know, had been incredibly frustrated inside these women's magazines and was kind of on a mission to blow them up.
Yeah. And that was Jezebel's early identity was all about attacking the bullshit of the glossy women's magazines.
And in the end was maybe the highest impact of all these things in terms of shaping where we are now. But I think—
Interesting. You think so? You think the way that Jezebel, Anna Wintour, the folks at Hearst and Condé Nast responded to the Jezebel, like taking them on?
Yeah. I mean, I think people in the political media can kind of underestimate the power of the glossies. But
yeah,
there are, you know, these massive cultural forces. And, you know, Anna was this insider who had been, you know, not really fit into these places where everybody was, you know, trying to dress and look like Anna Wintour, and she was black and she was from California and she was a feminist, and Denton was looking for somebody and didn't really know what, and thought he was like wanted someone to write a beauty blog because they would get a lot of beauty advertising, but Anna was basically more to his taste because she was so confrontational in her journalism, in whatever you'd call it. And just sort of waged this totally frontal assault on these glossies in pointing out that there were no black models, you know, which, you know, they were reading and were obsessed with, and making fun of Fashion Week and writing about periods and just like all the stuff that was just ran totally counter to the kind of glossy image that they were projecting of what it was to be a woman. And the thing that feels so contemporary reading that stuff now was that she just like broke through and had this incredibly, this is in 2007, immediate relationship with thousands of people who were reading the site, were obsessed with the site, loved it, but also had a like really intense parasocial, what feels really unsettling relationship with the writers, who felt captive to their audience, who were very disturbed in some ways by what they were getting back from their audience, who were getting pushed to more extreme places by their audience and by this feedback loop.
That's interesting.
I was like sort of writing about that. It's like, wow, like they kind of invented Twitter.
Yeah. They called themselves Jezzies.
Yeah. And it was enormously powerful, had huge impact, but like at a real high, like psychological cost to the women who created it. And it couldn't really last. And after that first year or two sort of settled
and
down.
I mean, I found it so funny because Nick Denton did not know what he was getting into when he hired Anna Holmes to run Jezebel.
No, and he hated it. No.
He didn't want a feminist blog.
No, he liked the traffic, but he thought he was going to be selling like lip gloss, and it was not that.
It was not that at all. Take us through pick up the story when you suddenly enter the picture with BuzzFeed. When you were originally approached by Jonah to run the editorial side, what was the goal? And why was that worth taking the risk jumping into that world?
I mean, to go back a little, I've been at Politico since the start. I mean, I was not a founder. I was an employee. I was a blogger.
Yeah.
But in a way, what Politico and I would say The Verge, the tech site particularly, did was to take these tools associated with blogging, the reverse chronological publishing, and say, oh, we can just do journalism here. Like we can gather facts and publish them, and we can send emails, and we can use these internet tools to do what in many other ways is quite conventional fact gathering, reporting, making trouble journalism. And that had been this incredible advantage and just was so fun for those first several years. And I was there, I guess, for 5 years. But by maybe 2009, 2010, I could just feel that all the energy, all the sources, all the readers who had been surrounding my blog, which covered mostly Democratic politics, had moved over to Twitter. And that I was writing blog items not for people who would visit my blog and connect to me, but for people who would see them on Twitter and share them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really like think about it in any particular abstract way. But when Jonah approached me, slightly at random, about coming over to BuzzFeed, you know, he sort of explained this vision of an internet that I was like, you know, that was basically where people sit down at their, you know, mostly desktop computers, maybe their laptop computers, and open Facebook.com and Twitter.com and go there rather than typing in Politico.com or BuzzFeed.com. And that then the challenge for a journalist is, how do you get your stuff in there? rather than how do you get people to come to your page? Like that really was like, oh, that's what I'm doing. And the worst thing at Politico when I was there was like, ugh, I have to write something for the homepage. So boring.
Got
for
it.
Readers like to come like to the homepage.
Like an actual story.
Yeah, like that's so old fashioned. Like that's like writing for a newspaper.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, these things come full circle.
And Twitter had replaced the blog. At that point, you realized Twitter had replaced the blog.
Yeah, and the blogs were this sort of proto-social media, and Twitter was the sort of fully realized version in some ways. And I loved it, by the way. And so the notion of kind of hiring up a little staff that treated Twitter as the homepage of our website, because that's how we thought about it, was this huge force multiplier. So we just weren't going to spend any of our time writing stories to fill space or to sort of, you know, that had already been written by somebody else. Like the only way to cut through on Twitter in that moment was to say something new and to break news, which of course is like what reporters like to do most. And so it was very rewarding.
And so one thing we're skipping over here a little bit is just the, and I want you to just to talk a little bit about that period where Jonah and folks at Gawker are really at the forefront of figuring out SEO and figuring out what eventually becomes like becoming a slave to the Facebook algorithm. And it all seems to be the future. Tell us a little bit about that period and like what the lessons are now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it felt for people who basically developed these tools where you could visualize where your readers were coming from and how to get more of them, whether that was search engines or Facebook. Like it was this crazy breakthrough, like they discovered oil, you know? And
yeah,
if they
yeah.
adjusted the angle of their drill, they could get more of it and they could sell advertising next to it. And that seemed like the future of media. And, you know, at Gawker, right, there was a big board with the traffic and writers were compensated based on it. BuzzFeed had more or less, the same thing. And I think at HuffPost, Jonah had in some sense invented that kind of traffic display that everybody has now. I mean, I think that there were two things that they didn't anticipate. Or maybe I'm not actually sure that we didn't anticipate it. It's just that we couldn't stop it. One was that for a commodity to have value, it needs to be scarce. And at first, you know, it was if you were an advertiser trying to reach a certain kind of person, going to Jezebel to reach, you know, young women or going to Deadspin to reach sports fans, made a ton of sense. Like, where else were you going to get them on the internet? But as Google in particular swallowed up big chunks of the advertising technology industry, as social media grew, suddenly you had these technology platforms with effectively infinite scale at reaching anyone. And you could target them not based on what they were reading, but who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd gotten whatever, 20 cents for a click. Suddenly you were getting 10 cents for a click and then 5 cents for a click. And maybe you were sort of even your revenue was still going up because you were getting, you know, more and more and more traffic. But the sort of speed of the treadmill kept accelerating. And that would, you know, a few years later, just sort of flatline all these companies.
You write about, I'm sure you have mixed feelings about what's happened to BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed is now kaput, and I'm assuming you're not going to be able to update.
Pretty unmixed feelings.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to update your book, but it's coming out obviously a very relevant time, considering that this is one of the companies that you follow through. At BuzzFeed, you created a newsroom there. You instilled it with traditional news values. You guys won a Pulitzer and, you know, most other major awards. You write a little bit about the tension between the business side and the editorial side and the sort of chase for traffic. Tell us a little bit about the sort of key moments in that debate where, you know, you weren't willing to become the Breitbart of the left.
And I think one thing that we were always fairly clear about was to do legitimate news was not the cheapest way to get traffic. I mean, news is more, you know, it's just more expensive to employ people who check facts, who don't write things if they don't turn out to be true, who tell people things sometimes that they don't want to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not how you get traffic. You get traffic by telling people what they want to hear. And in a kind of entertainment, in a light context, that's great. Like, there's just no harm in being like, you know, here are 15 things you know if you're an Italian American who grew up in New Jersey. Like, that's fun, right? Like, there's no...
Olivia would love that listicle.
That's what I was thinking. A lot of totally harmless stuff. But when you get into news, you sort of face constant choices about, are you going to just tell your audience exactly what they want to hear? Or are you going to not... Are you gonna disappoint them sometimes? And the internet made those trade-offs so tangible. At Huffington Post, there was sort of an elegant solution to that, which was Barack Obama drove all the traffic. And the people running it were fundamentally Obama people for different reasons. Ariana had hated Hillary since the 90s. Ken Lehrer, the other co-founder, was, you know, was a progressive Democrat who was very into Obama and was a big supporter. And Jonah loved the traffic. Obama drove traffic, particularly from Digg, which was a big referrer back then.
Yeah.
So the way they got traffic was writing good things about Barack Obama and bad things about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. And they were lucky enough to have that race in the, you know, shortly after their launch.
Yeah. And that's where they were coming from. And so it sort of felt like it was all kind of aligned. Where we really felt it at BuzzFeed was that, you know, we were pretty committed to playing it straight and, you know, finding an audience who wanted the news. But Bernie Sanders was just obviously a lot more viral than Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And we, you know, basically made a choice to try to cover the race fairly and obviously sacrificed a lot of traffic for that. And the person who really called me out on that and who sort of said that they couldn't believe I was doing it was Steve Bannon. I had a cup of coffee with him at Trump Tower in the summer of 2016. And I don't know what we were doing. I was trying to get information from him and he was, you know, giving me advice about media, more or less. He had been the chairman of Breitbart. And he was just incomprehending that we wouldn't just chase the sort of populist energy toward Bernie Sanders.
The way that he pointed Breitbart in Trump's direction and just sort of made it Trumpart.
Right, exactly.
And he didn't understand that there was a sort of, you know, you guys were covering the race. You weren't going all in for one candidate.
Yeah, I mean, I think we, you know, fundamentally had these basically establishmentarian values that we want to be fair and, you know, accurate and honest and give people a clear choice when it comes to really high stakes political choices. But of course, like that kind of stuff is part of why I think as social media really opened up and became this wide open space, it became a playground for the right.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in 2008, I think a lot of people saw Barack Obama's election as the culmination of this new media wave that was obviously progressive. Obama visited Facebook, you know, and that made total sense. They were his allies. That was where this sort of new youthful progressive energy was coming from. And I think, you know, when he won again in 2012, it was like, right, like Obama owns the internet.
Yes.
And I think what we all saw in 2016 was not only as, you know, more people got online, as everybody got online, the illusion that these digital tools were sort of innately progressive was just because young people were the first to adopt them. But as older and more conservative people got online, not only did they change the conversation and shift it to the right, but also there was a new right-wing populism that just didn't have the brakes on accuracy and fairness that a lot of the progress, even the sort of center-left media had. And so, you know, they just sort of set up these attack machines that were totally focused on serving the movement and getting Donald Trump elected. And in some sense, then, the 2016 election was, you know, it was the real culmination of this whole shift to digital media.
Absolutely. I mean, this story about your meeting with Bannon and the difference of opinion on that could not be a better illustration of what you're talking about and why BuzzFeed didn't go all in for Bernie, but Breitbart did for Trump. It's so, so telling. This is a good place to talk about what I think is already one of the most talked about chapters in the book, and that is your first person account of publishing the Steele dossier at BuzzFeed. This quote stuck with me when I was reading it. You write, although Nick Denton had abruptly exited the scene in the middle of 2016 when he lost the Hulk Hogan lawsuit, I was still carrying quite a bit of his DNA. In particular, I had deeply internalized his view that the job of journalists in the 21st century was to reject the patronizing gatekeepers who thought they knew what was best and simply to print what we had. Tell us about printing that dossier.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously something I've thought a lot about since. And I would say that, I mean, all stories are specific and weird. And the dossier was a specific weird situation, like all stories. And so I do think that my big picture ideology then and now, really, is that, you know, you should err on the side of sharing something with your audience, that people nobody wants you to keep secrets from them anymore, and they don't trust you if you do. And so that's my bias, I would say, broadly. That doesn't mean that you, whenever some crazy allegation lands in your email address, you screenshot it and tweet it, right? But and so it's, you know, it's sort of, it's still case by case, and I think much more traditional people, and I would end up in the same place on 95% of cases. Yeah. The dossier was this really, I mean, interesting study in this, where it had been handed to a bunch of elite reporters by the folks at Fusion GPS to, you know, further investigate as an off-the-record thing, and it had spread like wildfire around Washington and was having like real impact at the highest level of American politics before the election. Harry Reid, in particular, had written a letter, a public letter to Comey in October of 2016 that obviously alluded to it.
Yeah, said, there said, are these allegations. I understand you have this information in your possession, but without saying what the information was.
And nobody really knew what the hell he was talking about in the election.
I remember
happens.
It at the time. Yeah.
Crazy. And he would sometimes say stuff, right? And so who knows? And if you're in that Washington world, like a lot of people have seen this document and know about it. A lot of journalists, a lot of sort of people in the security establishment, a lot of politicians, including John McCain. And if you're trying to understand like what is happening in Washington around Trump, like why is McCain keeping his distance from Trump in this very particular way? Why are people in the Obama administration behaving in such and such a way? Like it becomes sort of just as an observer who has the dossier and is watching them behave in such a way, you're like, oh, this is why, but I'm not allowed to tell my audience this.
Yeah.
You know, that does not necessarily mean you should publish the thing, but it does start to put some pressure on, well, what are we going to do about this document that, by the way, a lot of reporters have basically been sworn to secrecy and have and can't talk about, adds a layer of complexity to it. We had gotten it through a weird side door. It was a great reporter, Ken Bensinger, had gotten a copy, later came out in court from a McCain aide, and was not sworn to secrecy in exactly the same way as the people who got it from Fusion GPS. But the first thing we did, which
he
everybody else did too,
he left was try in to a room with it without clear instructions about whether he could take
a classic
copy.
A classic form of Washington information sharing. Leave the reporter in the room, do not give them explicit permission to take it,
Ken took pictures of it, went to a coffee shop, and then, you know, sent it to you and others.
You know, but we basically did what everybody else did. We sent reporters to Prague and to Moscow and tried to figure out, like, these specific allegations in the dossier, can we knock them down? Can we stand them up? And, you know, some of them were clearly true, but basically evident. For instance, that the Russians had meddled in social media to try to exacerbate Bernie Sanders supporters' anger. And others were sort of ungettable, you know, but also hard to falsify. And so I think we were in the same position as most people where we weren't sure. So this is all sort of bubbling as CNN reports that this document has been briefed to not one, but two presidents, to Trump and to Obama, the president and the president-elect, and that it contains compromising information about Donald Trump that we're not going to tell you about. And honestly makes it seem, to my reading, more credible than it is. I mean, it's the sort, you know, it's not, I don't think they were intending this, but it is the old, I hold in my hand a list of, you know, 100 suspected communists in the State Department. There's nothing with more power than a secret document that you haven't been shown.
Yeah.
And so to my mind, at that point, it was really an obvious call to publish it. I don't think it was complicated.
When Tapper did his piece.
Yeah, Tapper and his colleagues. Yeah, which was a great scoop.
Yeah. Jake wasn't very happy with you.
Yeah, I mean, understandably. But like, you know, it was a great scoop and it moved the thing out of the darkness into a kind of shadowy space where you could see the document, but not quite, the light wasn't good enough to read it.
Yeah,
and that just felt totally untenable to me. Like you're going to tell everyone, I've seen this document, not sure what to make of it, but everybody in Washington's seen it. They're all making decisions based on it. But if you were to look at it, it would burn your eyes out. Sorry. You know, lawyer, teacher, regular person. I think that's totally untenable as a sort of proposition. And that's why we published it. We had a lot of qualms about it and, in fact, wrote a story to go with it saying, we haven't been able to stand this stuff up. We're publishing it because it's become itself part of the news. But there are like specific, relatively minor errors in it that make us nervous. The thing that I wish I could take back is that disclaimer and that caveat goes in one direction. The PDF document goes in another and never the twain shall meet again.
What could you have done different? Could you have done a PDF that was sort of annotated or redacted, or was there any in hindsight? Is that something you would have done, or were there other things in hindsight that you wish you had done?
I mean, yeah, I think I would have technically tried to staple the things more closely. In the end, I'm not sure how much that would have mattered, but yeah.
looking over that, are there any things you would have done different in that episode?
Yeah, I would have essentially tried to attach the context to the document in a way that made it much harder for it to float free.
Yeah, so when it traveled, it had that with it. Ben, it was a great conversation. The book is excellent, and I think our listeners will get a lot out of it. Thanks for doing this, man.
Thank you so much for reading the book and for having me on.
And that's our show. Our producers are Kara Tabor and Afra Abdullah. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Jenny Amont is Politico's executive producer of audio. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. And special thanks to Joe Dobkin for field production in New York this week. Please subscribe to Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.